Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we have two very special guests lined up for you. The first guest is Robert Watson of the World Bank. Now, he may not be a household name, however, he made history as being the director of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which eventually went on to win the Nobel Prize. Mr. Watson made history because he was removed as the head of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change by former President George W. Bush. But the irony is that the replacement for Mr. Watson was even a more activist person than he was. And in the second half of Exploration, we'll be bringing on Robert Mann. If you've been glued to the TV set over the last few years watching CSI and the science behind it, you may be wondering, well, how much of it is accurate and how much of it is just hokum coming from Hollywood? Well, we have one of the nation's leading forensic scientists with us today, Dr. Robert Watson, author of a book called Forensic Detective. And we'll be talking about the science or lack of science behind CSI. Also, let me say once again that if you get the Science Channel, tune into my weekly science program called Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible. It airs every Wednesday on the Science Channel, featuring everything you ever wanted to know about time travel, teleportation, force fields, phasers, warp drive, parallel universes, starships, all of it on Sci-Fi Science on the Science Channel. Well, today, as a consequence, I'll be airing some reruns of previous Exploration programs. In the first part of Exploration, we're going to run an interview with Robert Watson of the World Bank. He may not be a household word, but he's perhaps one of the most influential environmentalists on the planet Earth. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change made history when it defied national governments and laid it out concerning global warming. But who was the head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of the United Nations? It was Robert Watson. In fact, President George W. Bush was so angered and disturbed by some of the conclusions of the United Nations that he lobbied to have Robert Watson removed. And in a very controversial move, the United States pressure actually succeeded in removing Robert Watson from the head of the World Bank. Ironically enough, the replacement for Robert Watson, who is thought to be pliable and more subservient to United States interests, actually turned out to be even more vehemently a defender of the environment than Robert Watson. And in the second part of Exploration, we're going to talk about the science of CSI with Robert Mann, one of the leading forensic scientists in the United States. And so is it true about all they do with DNA and fibers and footprints? What about the truth behind CSI? So once again, in the first part of Exploration, we talk about the state of the world and the environment with one of the world's leading environmentalists, Robert Watson, now at the World Bank. And in the second part of Exploration, we explore the science of CSI. Mr. Watson, the first question for you is, why is the World Bank interested in the question of projecting what ecosystems may look like into the future?
Fundamentally, the world's ecosystems are basically the foundation for sustainable development. They affect economic growth, they affect poverty, they affect human well-being in many ways, including human health. And so the role of the World Bank is indeed to try and reduce poverty throughout the world, increase the livelihoods of the poor, and help countries that have sustainable economic growth. Our view is that unless we understand environmental issues and how we can couple environmental issues with economic issues, we cannot have a sustainable world.
Okay, now the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment Report involved a huge number of scientists from different countries, 1,300 scientists, I understand, from 95 countries. How did you assemble such a large, massive study, and who funded it, and how many years did it take to assemble this vast amount of information?
The overall study was somewhere around 4 years, and there was a wide range of sponsors, primarily some of the major foundations in the USA, including the Packard Foundation, the United Nations Foundation, then the Global Environmental Facility, which is primarily funded by OECD countries to try and look at key environmental issues of climate change, biodiversity, desertification, water resources. They provided the single most amount of money. The World Bank also contributed money to it. And then, of course, the main contributors actually were the individual scientists themselves that gave their time completely free of charge. Then a number of governments also helped, especially with what we call our subglobal assessments. That is to say, assessments that were either at the regional level, national level, or subnational level. Overall, as I said, it was a 4-year process. We reached, once we designed the project, and we had probably 100, 150 scientists help us design the project, we reached out to governments of the world, the private sector, the NGOs, some of the big conventions, such as the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Convention on Desertification, and we asked them to nominate experts from around the world. What was most important to us was effectively that we had good geographic balance, that is to say, experts from all countries of the world, that we had what we call stakeholder balance, that is to say, we had experts from universities, intellectual think tanks, governments, the private sector, and NGOs. And we had a board of directors of almost 50 individuals, primarily of users, that would be from the private sector to the conventions, the governments, to make sure that what we were writing was of use and would address the questions that are being faced by decision makers, whether they're in the private sector, whether they're consumers, or whether in government. And so it was a very, very interesting multi-stakeholder social process.
Okay, well, it's quite commendable that 1,300 scientists from 95 countries were involved in this massive study. But let's get into some of the conclusions of the study. Your study projects what the world may look like out to 2050. So let's talk about some of the basic conclusions of your report, including like population and resources. So let's start off by saying first, asking first of all, what do you project the population of the Earth may look like, and what are the stresses on the planet given the fact that we have to have clean water and food for these people?
Yeah, we did a number of that demographic projections, as you said, and we estimate that the world's population in 2050 is likely to be higher than it is today. And it could well be anywhere in the region of, say, I'm going to round the numbers, 8 to 10 billion people. We have over 6 billion people today. And we projected forward what could it look like in 2050. And we believe it will increase to somewhere a low number of sort of just under 8 billion people to a high number, just under 10 billion people. Obviously, it's an uncertain number because it is a projection. But the biggest challenge probably to ecosystems may not be the increase in population, or at least it will be coupled with an increase in wealth. Over the next 50 years, not only will we see, let's say on average, an increase in the number of people by 50%, just over 6 billion people to just over 9 billion people, but it is likely the world's wealth, the world's gross national product, may well go up by as much as a factor of 4. So instead of having an economy around $35 trillion a few years ago, we may well have a world economy almost as much as $150 trillion. And therefore, the combination of more people and wealthier people who can afford to buy more food, buy more energy, will require more access to water. It's that combination of more people and a wealthier world that will really put the stress on the world's ecosystems.
Well, let's first talk about food, for example. Will we have enough to feed these people, especially because China and India are undergoing an industrial revolution, creating a very large, vast middle class? Won't there be an enormous demand, especially if people want to have a middle class diet of hamburgers and beef and things like this?
Well, we already today, unfortunately, have about 800 million undernourished people in the world. It's a number not too dissimilar from even 10 years ago, the early 1990s, where there's equally about 800 million. So the total number of undernourished people in the world has not decreased in the last decade, even though there's been more food available and it's actually cheaper than it has ever been today. If you actually analyze what is it today compared to 10 years ago, and then I'll move forward to 2050, what you find is there's been a significant decrease in the number of hungry people in China, but actually an increase in sub-Saharan Africa. In other words, in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, we're going backwards, not forwards, in meeting the challenge of hunger alleviation. We then moved our projections forward to the year 2050, and we had a wide range of projections. We looked not only at potential changes in demography, number of people, did they live in cities, did they live in the rural area. We did have a range of economic growth, ranging from about a low of 1% GDP per capita up to almost 3% GDP per capita. So from a fairly low growth to a fairly high economic growth. We also looked to see if the world might socio-politically work together as one uniform world, or would it be a very fragmented world. So we looked at some of the political changes that might occur. We looked at some technological changes. So we looked at a wide range of plausible changes into the future. Even in what I would call our most favorable world, and that was a world with strong economic growth, the world working together in unison, strong effort to reduce poverty. Even in that world, we only reduced down the number of undernourished people by maybe a half to maybe a third of what it is today. And with respect to children under five that were undernourished, again, we did not get rid of child undernourishment. We simply brought it down by about a factor of three. Obviously, that's a step in the right direction. In our other worlds, which I could say were less favorable with respect to hunger alleviation, and two of them, there was a slight decrease relative to today, and one, there was actually an increase in the number of hungry people relative to today. So in none of our scenarios did we get rid of, unfortunately, hunger or poverty. And even in the world that had the most significant improvement in the number of hungry people, that is to say our ability to provide food, it came at a major expense of the world's ecological system. The only way we managed to increase that food, get it to people, was a continued expansion of agricultural land, which meant loss of the world's primary forest, which meant a loss of our ecosystem goods and services and biodiversity. And so what we recognize in these worlds is there are trade-offs. You can effectively reduce the number of hungry people, but it might come at the expense of losing much of our biodiversity today, therefore unsustainable.
Now, some people have claimed that we are sort of peaking with regards to fish harvest and grain harvest. Meanwhile, because countries are industrializing like China and India, there's going to be a vast demand for a middle-class diet. And that's somewhere there's going to be a day of reckoning, they say, given the fact that we're not seeing a new green revolution, and yet the demands will be enormous as people want a middle-class diet. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, 2 points on that. First, there is absolutely no question we're starting to see a livestock revolution in the world. That is to say, as people do become slightly wealthier, they get out of poverty, they are demanding a diet of more fish and more meat. In other words, they are following the classical Western diet. That's going to put tremendous pressure on our ability to grow enough that grain, even to feed the animals to produce the meat. So clearly that is, and that was taken care of in one of our scenarios. And that's why one needed such an expansion of agricultural land in order to produce the fodder for the animals, basically. So it wasn't just food per se, like grains and cereals. It was indeed fodder for the animals themselves. And so that is indeed going to place a major, major challenge. Secondly, with respect to cereals, as you say, the first green revolution appears to possibly be running a little bit out of steam. The rate of improvement of the amount of cereal we could produce per hectare went up tremendously in developing countries in the 70s, 80s, and then it started to flatten off very significantly in the 1990s. Hence, there's no question that it is a major challenge for the scientific community to get what we will actually call a second green revolution. That is to say, we've got to again increase the yield per hectare of the crops we grow, and we must do it in a much more environmentally sustainable manner. With respect to the oceans, we're in a very sad situation. 25% of the world's oceans are overfished. 50% of the world's ocean are probably at the maximum capacity to fish, and only 25% of the world's ocean has the potential for an increased fish yield. And if you look at effectively what we'd call the fish catch, globally, that is, over the last, say, couple of hundred years. It peaked probably about 10 years ago, and it is now going down. And what we've seen in certain parts of the world, such as fishing cod off of Newfoundland, some of these fisheries have absolutely collapsed. And the fishery industry off of Newfoundland for cod collapsed in 1992. And even with a moratorium on fishing cod off of Newfoundland, it has not recovered in the last 13, 14 years. So there's a real warning sign to us that we've got to be much more judicious in the way we fish and make sure that the fishing is indeed sustainable. Now, having said all of that, I'm an optimist. I'm a technological optimist that we can effectively improve agricultural yields, etc. But our challenge is how to have that second green revolution in such a way that it doesn't put adverse stress on our soils, on our waters, and our natural ecological systems. And that's the challenge that's facing the science community at the moment. And just as an aside, the World Bank, working with six other international organizations, including the Food and Agricultural Organization in Rome, the United Nations Environment Program in Nairobi, we're actually conducting a major international agricultural assessment that builds upon the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment and fundamentally asks the question, what is the role of the agricultural sector and agricultural knowledge, science, and technology in feeding the world in a sustainable manner, improving the livelihoods of the poor, and getting economic development to be more sustainable? So there's another major assessment that builds on the MA, specifically looking at the issue you just talked about.
Okay, moving on, let's talk about energy. Some people have said that we seem to be peaking with regards to oil, and we could be seeing in the next decade or so a decline in the rate at which we can extract oil from the ground. And some people are saying, therefore, that we could be headed for a huge energy crisis because we're not prepared for a downturn in oil. And yet nations like, again, India and China are going to demand a lifestyle that is comparable to that of the West, which has to be energized by fuel. So what are your thoughts?
We didn't take a very, very deep look at the energy issue in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, primarily because there's another very big assessment going on in parallel, which is the fourth Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Assessment that's looking at the whole energy-climate nexus. Also, there's some other people, such as the International Energy Agency, that have been looking at this issue of the energy crisis. There appears to be a spectrum of views of whether we are or are not going to run out of oil in the next 10 or 30 or 50 years. It does appear that every time we say there's a crisis, we seem to discover some new oil. But I think this is a critical issue that we have to look at. What are the facts? What oil is available over the next 10 to 50 years, and at what cost, and at what environmental cost? In other words, there may be oil in certain parts of the world, but extracting it comes at a high environmental cost. So I think it is a very, very critical issue we have to look at. And the aspect of the critical issue is, how do we provide energy that isn't just electricity, but modern energy services for the 2 billion people in the world? That's one third of the world's population that doesn't have modern energy services. They don't have heat. They don't have electricity. These are people that are very, very susceptible to indoor air pollution, where they have to burn dung or charcoal with a high mortality loss. And so feeding the world's energy demand is critical. And the challenge there, of course, is how do we manage it in a way that is environmentally sound? How do we do it without causing outdoor air pollution? How do we do it without causing climate change? And so the challenge of energy is not only finding that energy that is cheap, cost effective, but managing that energy system in a way that does not threaten the world's climate system. And so while much of the electricity may well come from coal, and there's actually plenty of coal today, probably 200-300 years worth of coal, basically, one of the bigger challenges is liquid fuels, i.e. what's going to propel our cars. And so looking for much more efficient cars, whether they're hybrid cars or a totally different sort of technology, is going to be one of the key challenges that we must be facing.
Okay, and you mentioned climate change. Even though perhaps the basic thrust of your report didn't address that in as much detail as we would like, what are your thoughts about what's happening with the climate? Some ecologists are saying that we could be hitting a point of no return, a point at which, no matter what we do, for example, the Arctic will be basically melted over summertime. And that, of course, would cause enormous repercussions throughout the planet Earth. But what are your thoughts?
Yes, well, I was the chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for the third assessment report. And the World Bank is extremely interested in this particular issue of climate change and development, because we do see climate change as a major threat to poverty alleviation and to development. And so the World Bank's doing a very significant amount of work itself at the moment to see how can we effectively produce energy that is cleaner, that is to say, that doesn't threaten the Earth's climate system. And we're trying to put together an interesting think piece on how can you finance clean energy. So there's a lot of work between the bank and other international organizations of how we could have a change in the financing so that we can find what I'd call clean energy. We're also spending a significant amount of time thinking there certainly will be some level of climate change. It's already occurring. Future change is inevitable. Our challenge as a globe is to what degree can we limit that future climate change, and therefore we're spending a lot of time thinking through how can we work with our client countries to limit their vulnerability to climate change, to limit their vulnerability of their agricultural sector, their water sector, human health through things such as vector-borne and waterborne diseases. And so the climate change issue is a very, very critical one, and it's clearly one that all major countries in the world have to decide how to produce the energy they need for economic growth and poverty alleviation, but how can they do it in a way that actually helps to protect the Earth's climate system. So this is indeed a major development challenge as far as we're concerned, and we, among many other institutions in the academic community, are trying to give some real serious thought to it.
Now, I understand with ice cores, we can now go back up to perhaps 600,000 years, projecting the weather of the Earth in the past, almost a million years. And given the fact that the 1990s came out as the hottest decade ever recorded in the history of science, is it still possible to say that human activity had nothing to do with this?
Well, the IPCC concluded in its last report that I chaired when we released it in 2001, that most of the observed warming of the last 50 years can be attributed to human activities. As soon as we released our report, the United States National Academy of Sciences was asked to review that particular report, and they basically endorsed the conclusions of the IPCC. Since then, about a dozen national academies of the world also looked at that particular report and endorsed the findings. I would say that the very, very large majority of scientists do conclude that we humans are the cause of the change in climate. And hence our challenge now is how can we move forward and therefore have a clean energy paradigm. That is to say that we produce our energy in a way that is friendly to the climate system, does not cause climate change. So I think this is indeed one of our biggest environmental or biggest development challenges that we face.
And of course, it's impossible to project the future, but if you were to look into the next 10, 20, 30 years with regards to climate change, and you were to look at the various scenarios, what are some of the conclusions? Are we talking about basically the North Polar region becoming a gigantic puddle? Are we talking about a gradual breakup of the Antarctic, rising sea levels? What are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, we did look at this in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, and we broadly concurred with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The basic picture is that over the next 100 years, the Earth's temperature globally could well increase 1.5 to almost 6 degrees Celsius. That is about effectively 2.5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit over the next 100 years. There would be changes in precipitation, where there would probably be more precipitation at temperate and high latitudes, less precipitation in the subtropics. We also suggested, based on all the theoretical modeling and observations, that the sea level would indeed continue to increase, possibly as little as 10 centimeters, 2.5 inches, but as much as possibly 1 meter or 3 feet over the next 100 years. The basic ramifications for human society are, unfortunately, while there may be an increase in food production in temperate regions for small changes in temperature, although with high it would also decrease, high being greater greater than 3 degrees Celsius. In the tropics and subtropics, almost any warming of the Earth's climate would lead to a loss of food production, the very places where we have hunger and poverty today. We also projected that the arid and semi-arid areas of the world would become even drier. There would be more heavy precipitation events and less light precipitation, meaning there would be both more floods and droughts. There could be an intensification of the strength of hurricanes. The theory suggests there may not be more hurricanes, but it is highly suggestive that when we do get hurricanes, they would be more intense. There's also the possibility that there would be an increase in the incidence of vector-borne diseases such as malaria and dengue fever, and an increase in water-borne diseases such as cholera. Then when you come back to ecosystems, like we looked in great detail in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, our conclusion is that while climate may not have been the biggest driver of biodiversity loss in the last 100 years, other issues such as fragmentation of ecosystems, the conversion of the ecosystems, pollution from phosphorus and sulfur, these were probably were bigger drivers in the past. But over the next 100 years, climate change is likely to be as big or bigger than the other causes of loss of biodiversity and ecosystem goods and services. So fundamentally, a changing climate can have adverse effects in many parts of the world on food, water, human health, sea level, displacing people that live in coastal areas, and on our ecological system. So yes, it's a major challenge.
Now, if you were to take like the middle range within the projections that you mentioned and then project what the Earth will look like, even in the middle range, we're talking about a massive disruption of the economies of the world, right? Growing areas are going to change. Famines, droughts could take place with violent extremes of the weather. Coastal regions may be flooded by gigantic storms that loft water right into their subway systems, like I'm here in Manhattan right now. And it wouldn't take that much to inundate the entire subway system with a massive storm. So even in the middle range, we're talking about a massive disruption of the economy and the lifestyle that we're accustomed to, right?
Even in the middle range, which would be the temperature would increase somewhere around, say, 3 degrees Celsius by the year 2100, over the next 100, certainly changes in precipitation patterns, changes in sea level, melting of glaciers, they would lead in most parts of the world to negative effects. More people would be adversely affected by climate change than the few that could potentially benefit.
And that concludes our interview with Robert Watson of the World Bank, perhaps one of the most influential environmentalists on the planet Earth, former head of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration as we talk about the science of CSI. How much of CSI is really authentic? What about the techniques pioneered by forensic scientists? And we'll bring on Robert Mann, one of America's leading forensic scientists. Stay tuned. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Robert Watson of the World Bank, one of the most influential environmentalists on the planet Earth. In fact, he was so influential that President George W. Bush had him removed as the head of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. In fact, it was a case of out of the frying pan, into the fire, because the replacement for Robert Watson turned out to be even more vocal than Mr. Watson himself. Anyway, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about the science, or lack of science, of CSI. You've probably seen programs of that where they use the latest technology to unravel crimes, but how much of that is authentic? Well, with us today is one of America's leading forensic scientists, Robert Mann, and he'll take us through the science of forensic medicine. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Dr. Robert Mann, Ph.D., and he's the author of an exciting new book called Forensic Detective, How I Crack the World's Toughest Cases, which is a book that you should get if you are a CSI fan. Well, first of all, Dr. Robert Mann has a very long and distinguished career in forensic medicine, and in fact, he worked at the government's Central Identification Laboratory for nearly 13 years. He got his Ph.D. from the University of Hawaii. He's written 2 books and 95 papers in the popular as well as scientific literature. And he's only one of 73 scientists that have been certified as a diplomat of the American Board of Forensic Anthropology. And he's been involved in some very high-profile murder cases, chasing murderers like the serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer as well as the Poughkeepsie serial killer, not to mention the fact that he helped to identify the unknown soldier, the soldier that died during the Vietnam, and also has been involved in over 35 search and discovery missions around the world in Hanoi, Cambodia, North Korea, Latvia, as well as other areas of the earth, for example, looking for American MIAs. The first question for you, Dr. Mann, is how did you, as a youth, first get interested in science?
I was in a laboratory working, doing volunteer work at William & Mary in archaeology, and I was just numbering pottery, broken pieces of pottery and things like that. And an archaeologist walked over to me, and he had a bone in his hand, and he showed me this bone, and he said, "You know what this is?" And I said, "It's a bone." And he said, "Can you tell me anything more?" And I said, "No, it's a bone." And he said, "Well, it's a turkey bone." I thought, "Well, okay, it looks familiar now." And then he said, "It's this bone here, it's the right one, and it's this." And he told me a lot of information about this turkey. And he said, "You know, this turkey died a couple hundred years ago." And I thought, "Now, how can you tell all that from one single bone?" And he said, "Well, this is really nothing. You ought to see what they can tell from the human skeleton." And I said, "The human skeleton, they can tell a lot?" And he said, "Yeah." So I took a class at William & Mary in osteoarchaeology, the study of bones that are recovered in archaeological sites. And at that point, I was just hooked. I loved it. I couldn't get enough of it. While everybody else was out doing things on Friday and Saturday nights, I was reading archaeology and anthropology books. I was just hooked. I didn't know that you could tell anything from the human skeleton. I thought everything was on the outside. And come to find out, there's a lot that's on the inside.
Okay. And also, you've worked with the Central Identification Laboratory for nearly 13 years and also the Body Farm. So could you tell us a little bit about what kind of training goes into creating a forensic scientist?
Well, typically what you do is you get a bachelor's degree, an undergraduate degree. Excuse me. I've been getting over cold here for a month now. But you get a degree in anthropology, and there are different specialties in anthropology. There's archaeology, which is digging. There's linguistics, which is language. There's cultural anthropology, living peoples. And then there's physical anthropology, which is skeletons and teeth, you know, bones. And so I took a whole lot of classes, and I realized, well, what I really wanted to do is do the skeleton. That came under physical anthropology. So I took the one class at William & Mary. I learned how to identify bones, pieces of bones and complete bones, how to tell human from animal bones. And then I left William & Mary, and I went to the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, which is where the Body Farm is, which is Dr. Bill Bass, who's the big guru in teaching forensic anthropology. And once I got there, I again got hooked on forensic anthropology. I knew that you could tell a lot from bones, but I didn't know they had any legal value that you could tell a person's age, race, sex, stature, how they were killed, tell a gunshot wound from a stab wound. I had no idea you could tell all that stuff. So, again, I got invigorated, and it took off again. So I took more classes in bones at Tennessee, and then I started taking forensic anthropology classes, which is where Dr. Bass would bring a skeleton in early in the week, and he would present it to the class, and we had to examine it. And then the following week, he would write everybody's names up on the bulletin board and put columns of age, race, sex, stature, and you had to give your opinion, every student, what you thought. This is a white male. He was 20, 25 years old. He was 6 foot tall. He died of a gunshot wound. And then we had to discuss it, and whoever was wrong or the farthest off on the case had to explain why they came up with their conclusions. And that's where you really start realizing, okay, there's different opinions out there. There are different skill levels. And whatever it is that you write about a skeleton, you have to be able to back it up. And so at that point, I realized there's more to it, and I realized the importance of anatomy and, you know, gross anatomy. And so I started studying that, of x-rays. So radiology was very important, and forensic pathology. And back then, I even kind of got interested in hair analysis and in insects and decomposition of the body. And so kind of a natural progression was, I know there's a lot about the body you can tell. Now there's a lot about the skeleton you can tell. And also there's a lot to tell about how this person died and how long they've been dead. And at that point, I realized, okay, the body farm there is something I need to get involved in.
Okay, well, let's go through some of the very elementary basics. Like, if you're given a bunch of bones, human bones, I guess you can tell the sex by looking at the pelvis, right? But how do you determine the characteristics of the person in terms of age, sex, as I mentioned, when the person died? How do you tell?
Well, what we're looking at there, different parts of the skeleton will give us different pieces of information. And if you look at kind of the normal adult human skeleton, we have 206 bones in our body, and we have 32 teeth. We take good care of our teeth, and we end up with 32 and keep them throughout our lifetime. But some people have more than 206 bones. They have an extra rib or two or an extra vertebra in their spine. Some people have fewer. But what we look at when we look at the skeleton, we try to compile what we call the biological profile. It's kind of what's on your driver's license and a little bit more. It's the person's age of death, their race, their sex, their stature. Sometimes we can tell handedness if they use their right hand more than their left hand, and what the cause of death may have been. Were they shot? Were they stabbed? And what we're looking at, though, to tell the biological profile, person's age, race, sex, and stature, the big four, is we're looking at size and shape differences. When we recognize somebody walking down the street, we recognize them immediately by the color of their hair, all these different variables, their hair color, the shape of their face, the shape of their nose, their skin color, they've got moles, and the way they walk. A lot of that information, and people sometimes don't know this, a lot of the information that's portrayed on the outside of our body, in the soft tissue and hair, a lot of that is reflected in the bones underneath and is transferred to that. So even if you take away all the soft tissue and all you have is the bones, you can look at size and shape differences. For example, in the skull, there's three things immediately you can tell, a complete skull or even if it's broken up into pieces, because there are different features of the skull. It doesn't matter if the skull is complete or not. We can look at certain parts like the shape of your nasal bones. If they're very large and very prominent, then you know the person is probably Caucasoid. If they're flat and not very prominent and smaller, then it's probably Negroid. And if the nasal bones right between your eyes and at the top of your nose, if they're very tiny and very pinched, then they're probably Asian. So from the skull alone, we can tell a person's age at death, their race, and their sex. And if you move down to the hips, from the hips you can tell a person's age at death and their sex. You can't tell the race from pretty much from the neck down. So the racial features, again, which are size and shape differences, are reflected in the size and shape of the skull. And there are differences that we go with. For example, if you're looking at the teeth, somebody who is under 18 years old, the most reliable way to tell how old they were when they died is the development and eruption of the teeth. The teeth come through the gums and through the jaws at a very predictable rate. This first tooth comes in first, this other tooth comes in second. And so up until about age 18, give or take, we can tell within 6 months or so how old somebody was when they died. And once the teeth are fully formed and they've fully developed, they're stopping their growth. They're not going to change anymore unless they get cavities and things like that and you lose teeth. So up until a certain age, we're looking at growth changes in the skeleton. And in a child's skeleton has about twice as many bones as an adult skeleton. And that's because the bones in a child, because they're growing and they have to be able to adapt to these size differences as they grow, the bones in a child are in pieces. And when they start getting into their, you know, 10 years old and their early teens, the bones grow together and they come together. There are growth caps on all the bones that allow the bones to grow in length and in width. And so once you've achieved your adult status, maybe 18, 20 years old, your bones are all fused together, and what we're looking at then is degenerative changes. So we're looking at growth changes till you become an adult, and then we're looking at degenerative changes after that.
Okay, now you were involved with that notorious serial murderer, Jeffrey Dahmer, his first case. And speaking about bones, the bones were in pretty bad shape with his first victim. So tell us a little bit about Jeffrey Dahmer, about serial killers. They actually do exist. They're not a figment of Hollywood. And how you identify the victims.
Well, yeah, serial killers, you know, they can present some unusual problems for law enforcement and for anthropologists, the scientific community, and pathologists, because if they're good at what they do, you know, a serial killer becomes a serial killer. Now, this is the anthropologist speaking. This is not the profiler or the law enforcement person. But a serial killer becomes a serial killer because they're good at what they do, unfortunately. And so when they perfect their art, as they work towards perfecting their art of killing people, of abducting them, in reverse order, and then trying to dispose of the bodies, then they are really systematically trying to destroy the evidence. And we, on the other hand, have to try to systematically rebuild that evidence. So they make our jobs harder. They can dip bodies in acid. They can smash them up with hammers. They can saw them up with saws. And then they scatter those remains all over their, you know, a city or state or several states. And the hard part for us is trying to link those bones back together again. But we can do that. There is a principle, Locard's principle, where anybody entering a crime scene or a room or whatever, they're going to leave a little piece of themselves there, and they're going to pick up something from that scene, and they're going to take it with them. So there's a transfer of evidence. So sometimes that transfer of evidence helps law enforcement identify somebody. For us, when we're dealing with serial killers, for example, those two that I've worked with, Jeffrey Dahmer's first victim, and then Kendall Francois, who killed 8 women in Poughkeepsie, New York, and he dismembered their bodies. Well, for Jeffrey Dahmer, he picked up his first victim, took him back to his house, killed him, and then over a few days later, he dismembered his victim. And then he tried to totally destroy the body by breaking up the bones with a sledgehammer. And then he just stood in his backyard, and he scattered those remains to the winds, thinking that he had done his job. He had gotten rid of the evidence. But what he didn't know is that it's extremely difficult to dispose of evidence. Because if you take, committing the perfect murder is much more difficult than people would ever imagine. And I would be able to say that, being on the other side of the fence, saying, I'm trying to put these, you know, body parts back together, and I'm trying to undo what a serial killer had done. That's what forensic anthropologists do. But with Dahmer, he killed his victim, dismembered him, smashed up the bones, and just smashed them up as best he could, trying to destroy that evidence, and then he scattered it. But what he didn't know is we can go back 10, 20 years later, do an archaeological excavation of his backyard. We can find those pieces of bones and those pieces of teeth, and we can get those, and we can still identify somebody, despite their best efforts. And that's what we did with his first victim. The law enforcement, went out to his home in Bath, Ohio. They did a very systematic, very good archaeological excavation of his entire yard. And everything that they found in his yard, if it's animal bones or human bones or coins or spoons or whatever was tossed into the woods there, they collected all that evidence, they put it in paper bags, and they brought it to us at the Smithsonian in 1991. And they asked us, could we identify what they brought there, and could we identify this individual? The first thing we have to do, and the first thing we always tell people, is when remains are brought to us, any anthropologist out there, the first thing they have to do is you have to figure out if it's non-human or human. And in lay terms, you might say, is it human or animal? And we can tell that right away, again, by size and shape differences. A human femur, which is your thigh bone, looks different than a dog femur. And we can tell that immediately. Even if you break it up into pieces, we're going to be able to tell because there are unique features to those bones.
Also, tell us a little bit more about the Poughkeepsie serial killer whose bodies were actually left to decompose and create a horrendous stench. So this person was not in the business of trying to systematically obliterate the evidence, but he got away with it for a while, didn't he?
Yes, I think he ended up picking up and killing and dismembering. Well, he picked up and killed 8 women over a period of about 2 years. And he picked up the women on the streets, the prostitutes, brought them back to his house, and then he would have sex with them there and kill them. Presumably when his family was not there, but he was living in the same house with his mother, father, and daughter, mother, father, and younger sister. And I don't know all the details of that. Again, I work a different aspect of these cases, but my assumption is that his family was not home when he killed these women. What he did, though, is he took the first 3 women and he buried them, put them in shallow graves under the crawl space under the back of his house. And he just crawled up underneath there, put the body there, and he covered them with dirt. The next 5, he took them into his house, and I think he had done this perhaps in the attic. He dismembered them up there, and he placed the body parts in different containers, plastic bags and a plastic trash can in a small little, like a little kiddie wading pool. And he put them in plastic bags and he left them there. And, of course, nature took its course then, and the insects, the maggots, and bacteria and decomposition rendered a lot of the bodies down to bone. But some of them, there were body parts that were still there. And what happened is once he was found and the police went in there and got all the evidence, the bodies from the victims, they took them to the medical examiner's office, Dr. Barbara Wolf. And she started the examination. And at one point, I think when she had 6 or 7 legs that were there, she realized she could use the, you know, she enlisted our help over there. And so I went up and I helped her kind of reassociate the body parts. And that's something that we're very good at, especially if you got skeletalized remains or if you got decomposed remains. We're kind of, forensic anthropologists very often are called in. We're kind of the last link in the evidence chain or in the identification chain. And it's kind of like, not always, but in many, many cases, it's when all else fails and there's nowhere else to go, then they'll say, well, let's get an anthropologist in and see what they can do. Sometimes we can help with a case. Sometimes we can provide we can help identify them, or we can tell how many people are present. And that was one of the things that had to be done with the Kendall Francois's victims. The police wanted to know how many victims are there, and we were able to tell by putting the body parts back together, there were 5 women who had been dismembered, and they were up in the attic.
And also, of course, DNA is very important, especially in your involvement with identifying Vietnam's unknown soldier. So could you elaborate the usefulness of DNA?
Well, yes. DNA is a tool that I started here at the lab in 1992, so about 14 years ago. And at that time, we weren't using DNA. So we had to rely on the conventional types of identification. Most identifications are made in the military kind of thing for ancient or for older deaths. They're made with the teeth. So if you've got dental records of the soldier, sailor, airman, or marine before he went off to combat and went missing or was killed, then that's very important for us. We have to have some dental records for the identification. And then what we need for the other piece of the puzzle is we have to recover some teeth from a crash site or from a grave. So if we get teeth, a jaw fragment or something like that with teeth in it, and especially if those teeth have some restorations, fillings and crowns and things, we get that from the crash site of the grave, our dentists will take x-rays of that, they will chart it, they will write it up and describe it, and then they will compare those recovered dental fragments or teeth with the dental records that the person had before they went missing. And they will make a comparison. A dental identification, because a dental filling is unique to everybody, that if once they make a comparison with a dental x-ray from remains recovered from crash site or grave, and they compare it to the dental records of the before the service member went missing, they can make a positive identification. And really what they're doing, again, is they're comparing the size and the shape of the dental fillings and the crowns and stuff with the after-death and before-death remains and x-rays. So the conventional form for most identifications, and at this lab still, most of our identifications are made dentally. But about 12 years ago, we started working with mitochondrial DNA. That was a new technology. And mitochondrial DNA is something that, we can get DNA from bones and we can get DNA from inside of teeth. And what we were able to do then is identify missing service members that we were not able to identify 20 years ago or 15 years ago, even 14 years ago. So now with DNA and what it takes to get DNA out of bone, you need a piece of bone about half the size of your thumb. And we cut that from the femur, which is the thigh bone or the tibia, the shin bone, things like that, almost anywhere in the body. And once we cut the sample, we send that to the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory in Maryland. That's a military lab that does all our DNA work. They will process the sample. They will get the DNA sequence out of it, and then we'll make the comparison between that bone fragment or the DNA from inside of a tooth with the missing service member. And if we, what we have to do is we, mitochondrial DNA is transmitted through the maternal bloodline. So it's passed down through the female bloodline from the mother to her children and the mother's sisters and things like that. And even the missing service members' brothers and sisters, they have the same mitochondrial DNA. So mitochondrial DNA is can be shared by more than one person in the world, unlike nuclear DNA, which can be unique. So right now, we use mitochondrial DNA to help in the identification process in probably 60 to 70% of our cases.
And what is the smallest amount of DNA you can work with? Like, for example, dandruff, saliva. What is the smallest piece of DNA you can work with, hair? And how far back in time can DNA be preserved?
Well, I think DNA can be preserved hundreds of years back in our own cases here. For example, the remains from the USS Monitor, the ironclad ship from the Civil War, we got DNA, usable DNA, back from one or two of those samples, and that goes back about 140 years or so in salt water. So mitochondrial DNA survives a long time and goes way back in ancient times. You can get mitochondrial DNA from different forms, from saliva, from hair follicles and things like that. We're less likely to use that. We try to get our DNA from bones and from inside teeth because there's a lot of variables. And I'm not a DNA expert, but I think it's more difficult to get it out of hair and nails and things like that. So we typically rely on a bone fragment or a tooth to get our mitochondrial DNA sequences.
Okay, and so could you elaborate a little bit about your work with military fatalities, including, of course, the unknown soldier, and also deaths from World War II and the Cold War to Vietnam?
Well, in my 14 years here, I've done a lot of missions, which I go out with search and recovery teams around the world. And I do missions for a variety of reasons. So I've gone to Russia, and I've gone to Latvia, Germany, Belgium, but also to a lot of missions to Southeast Asia, which is Vietnam, Laos, and a couple of trips into Cambodia, even Japan and Okinawa. So what we are trying to do, the laboratory here, JPAC, which is it's the military organization that's responsible for the search, recovery, identification of all missing service members from all past wars. We go all over the world, wherever there are missing service members, and we try to locate crash sites and graves, and then we excavate whatever is there, and we bring all of that evidence back to the lab here and make the identifications. But in so doing, I've worked with World War II cases. There are some each one of these cases is just it's so fascinating. Each one of them could be a book unto itself or a chapter unto itself. That the circumstances of loss and how these remains may be found by a farmer digging up his field in France, or villagers in the highlands of Vietnam run across an airplane, and it turns out that it could be an American remains there. They're so fascinating to try to put these pieces of puzzle back together and to kind of close the chapter or write the page that's been lost in history. Because many, many of these cases, World War II, World War I, Korea, Southeast Asia, we know the circumstances of loss. We know about where the airplane went missing, where the soldier went missing. But we have to find the crash sites. We have to find the graves. And once we do that and we can recover enough remains and material evidence to help us identify these individuals, identify the aircraft and things like that, we can provide closure for families that for 30 years wondered what happened to their loved one. And they may have suspicions that what happened to them and they went missing in combat, but they don't really know the circumstances. Were they shot? Were, you know, what happened exactly? We're able to provide many of those answers for family members and for friends. Doesn't matter if the person went missing in World War I. We just identified a ground loss that went back to World War I, 1917, 1918. And we've worked many cases from World War II. We're identifying bomber crews from Irian Jaya and from Tibet, from Papua New Guinea, all over the world. And a great deal of our work is in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our first special guest was Robert Watson of the World Bank, formerly head of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and one of the most influential environmentalists on the planet Earth. Our second guest was Robert Mann, one of America's leading forensic scientists, talking about the science of CSI. Well, once again, if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And be sure to dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. So far, we've logged over 110 million page hits on that website. So, once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics, inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. Good day.